All right. We did it. We're here.
I'm ready.
Another episode of Confessions of a Street Broker, and here with my dog, Keith.
What's up, Keith?
Keenan Cook. Yep. Keenan Cook, Mercer Company Vice President, dominate South Stemmons, the Hines market, and up into Valwood. And anyways, man, glad we did it.
I know.
Got you here.
It's been a while.
Has been.
I'm ready to make my debut with you.
Yeah. So debut on the kiz ass.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
So this is gonna be cool because I've seen every iteration of Keenan's real estate career. So
you were there at the Rice Career Fair.
Yeah. So
yep.
So I first met Keenan. Jeff and I went down to Houston for a Rice Athlete Career Fair day. And it's kind of like a big social mixer.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember looking at you at one point and said, just come on, dog. We got a job for you.
You did.
Just come on up.
Well, it's funny. I was in I think it was early January. We just finished practice. I think it started at like 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being in the locker room thinking, man, I'm not going to go to that. That's
wow.
I don't want to go. But I had my clothes hanging in the locker. So I said, all right, I'll go.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Here we are.
I'm glad I went. But
10 years later, 10 tours of duty later. So, yeah. All right. So let's just kind of start at the beginning. Tell us where you grew up, where you're from.
Yeah. From the Woodlands,
yep.
Texas, basically the Prosper of Houston,
Prosper North.
Maybe the South
the
Lake.
The South Lake.
Yeah.
Prosper area of Houston.
Yeah. So I grew up in the Woodlands. Had a great childhood. The Woodlands is truly a bubble. I mean, have you been there?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like little things like power lines. There's no power lines in the entire city. They put them all underground.
All underground.
So something silly like that you'd never realize, but you live there and then you go somewhere else. And I remember thinking, what are all these power lines doing? This is ugly. But yeah, I grew up, I was the youngest of three. Sports was pretty much all we did.
Yeah.
Baseball became the main sport. I played, you know, basketball, football, baseball, and then in high school I just played football and baseball.
Yeah.
And then went to college and played baseball at Rice, and that's kind of where everything started, was on the baseball field for me.
Well, all right. So what did your parents do growing up?
My dad was a high school history teacher.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a high school counselor.
Okay.
So my dad's whole side of the family were high school basketball coaches.
Okay.
Like his brother, his dad, his grandpa. And my dad was a coach right out of college. By the time I was born, he had just become a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I think basically, you know, if at that time the head football coach, who was the AD, if he left, then everyone's basketball coach, they're all leaving.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think he probably saw that and said, look, I don't want to have my family moving around every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he was a history teacher. Then he also had, I would say, a lawn mowing business, but it was really just him. But every day after school, he would mow lawns like 3 or 4 a day before he came home. And I mean, he was the definition of hard work for sure. Still is.
What an example.
it's crazy. When I look back, he used to wake up at, 4:30. This was pre-cold plunge days, but he didn't cold plunge. But
he didn't?
No. But he would always be up.
But he meditated, right?
Meditated,
come on, yeah.
He was always up early, gone. He worked at a inner city high school. It was a pretty, not a great part of town. I think he did that because the pay was higher there.
Oh, okay.
And then he'd go finish that up, go mow a couple lawns, and he'd always meet me and my brother at the batting cage and throw us batting practice. And man, he just did that for 20 years and didn't ask for a high five or any notoriety. He just did it.
Yeah.
And that's just what he did.
Yeah.
And I attribute a lot of just who I am from. That's how I was raised, man. It was nothing to see that. That was just normal. So I've realized that that's not normal as I get older. But yeah, I credit him with that work ethic that I saw it and was like, well, that's what I got to do.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that, you know, I always kind of view you as the ultra consistent guy. Like every week you make your calls, you do your organ, you do like everything every week.
Yeah.
And Jeff kind of calls it mowing the grass every week.
Yep.
And you're just out there mowing the grass that's like your dad is.
Yeah, that's what we always, I said that with him early, like, hey, it's just mowing the grass.
Just mowing the grass.
You gotta mow it, you gotta do a little weed eating sometimes.
And yeah.
Yeah, he was a great, still is a great example. Really just, yeah, man, just, I remember the first week working, waking up early thinking, oh my goodness, my dad's been doing this for 30 years. And like, I knew he did that, but yeah. When you actually have to go do it, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
It gave me, I remember it hit me like, wow, he's been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
And he's been doing it for us. And, you know, yep. Again, I didn't appreciate it until I got in the working world and saw what that's about. So pretty crazy.
It's like, congratulations, you only have 48 more years to go.
Yes.
Okay, so you go to high school in the Woodlands. So obviously, you know, you were a sought-after baseball player. Rice had a pretty significant program back then. So what? Tell us about recruiting and like, how did that kind of go with baseball? And
well, Rice was, I said it, maybe to you today. They were like the New York Yankees at the time of college baseball, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Someone would say different, but I was not a big recruit, but I played with a guy that was probably the top pitcher in the Houston area.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd have a lot of scouts come watch him. And I just remember they said, hey, John Sims is his name. They said, hey, John, I want you to come to this game and bring that Keenan Cook guy with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went, and I mean, for a Houston kid to be able to play baseball at Rice, that was the ultimate.
Yeah.
So when it came time and they offered me, I remember I was also, the number two would probably be A&M for me. Looking back, I wouldn't say that anymore, but I met with Rice. They offered me a scholarship. That day I had a summer ball game. The A&M coach was coming to watch me, one of the coaches. And I think I went like 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. And in the parking lot, I said, well, I just got an offer from Rice. Like I'm trying to make a decision. And he said, well, you can come to a camp in like 2-3 months and we'll look at you again. I said, okay, well, there's my decision.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, it was, I was fortunate, man. I was never a guy that had just tons of confidence in my baseball ability, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so to get an offer early like that really just was like a huge burden off my back. So it was.
When did you get your offer?
It was the summer after your junior year.
Okay.
They could contact you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it was before school started. So it was like a month after they could initially start talking to you. So
and when you got your offer, did you still have people coming after you, or you just kind of like, no, I'm committed. No.
Yeah, it was pretty much a done deal.
Yeah.
I had a couple other small schools that I was talking to, but once I told them that I was going to Rice, that was it.
And shut them down.
Shut them down.
All right. Yeah. Well, tell us about your baseball career. I know you lettered all 4 years there.
I did. So. Yeah. I would say I was a solid college player,
mm-hmm.
you know, team guy. I hit one home run my entire college career, which is not good for an outfielder. But yeah, my freshman year, I pretty much played almost every game. It's funny enough, before the first game, we were playing Stanford for the opening game, and they had this pitcher who was supposed to be, you know, the number one pick. And the week before, like, I didn't even know if I was going to make the actual like travel team.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, you know, maybe I'll make the travel team. Well, the coach came up to me like Tuesday, the game's on Friday, and said, hey, you're going to be the leadoff batter DH game one. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, like I'm on the team. So that was crazy. My sophomore year, there was a guy who got hurt, another outfielder. My freshman year, and when he got hurt, there's basically four of us. Then it became like only three of us. So I played all the time. Anyways, my sophomore year, he came back. He was an older guy. And so I was kind of the odd man out. And so I went from playing, you know, every day from, I don't know, 6 years old to this was the first time I was truly like a bench warmer.
Yeah.
And honestly, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're in the middle of it, the game just feels so much bigger than it really is. And when I took a step back and I'm sitting on the bench and I'm watching guys, I'm just like, man, just let it go. Just go out there and be aggressive, do the best you can. And, you know, you're going to fail. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
So that it gave me a different perspective that it just kind of helped me to let go of all the fear of failure and to just let it all out. So, yeah. And then from there, junior, senior year, I started both those years. So it was, we had a great run. We never made it to the College World Series. We got to the Super Regionals, which is the round right before the World Series. 1 year, we won conference every year. It was a great run, but you know, when you look back, I just remember the losses more than the wins, which is unfortunate. But but it was a great program and met a lot of my best friends there, and it was cool to be a part of for sure.
Well, so obviously, you know, you're at a great program, you're starting, but you kind of know it's probably the end is near.
Yeah.
How did you kind of, when did you kind of realize that and being like, you know, I got to really start thinking about a career?
Yeah, I would say, you know, in my senior year, I had talked to a handful of scouts, but I never grew up dreaming of playing professionally. Like that wasn't, for me, it was like, honestly, I want to go play in college, mm-hmm. and Rice would have been the goal.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that was ever attainable.
Yeah.
So I never really had that dream. And then I had a good junior year, and I remember a couple scouts approached me. And so I got in my mind for a second, well, maybe I could do this. But the reality was, I just wasn't, you know, if you don't hit home runs, yeah. if you're an outfielder, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I knew a few older guys that were, I say older guys, they were in their 30s and 40s and 50s that did real estate.
Mm-hmm.
I had no clue what real estate was. My major was economics. And I just said, well, whatever those guys are doing, it looks pretty good.
Looks like it's working.
Yeah. I was like, so I guess I want to do real estate, having no clue what that was.
Yeah.
And at that career fair where we met, I remember looking and there was like one real estate company, Mercer Company. And so I said, okay, I'm going to talk to them.
Yeah.
That's my goal. And that was really it. Like when I came up and rode around with Corby when I was still in college, I knew absolutely nothing yeah. about what we were doing, but seemed like y'all were successful folks. So I was like, let's go.
So you didn't interview anywhere else or anything, huh?
No, no other real estate companies. I had a couple like bank jobs, just being an economic major, mm-hmm. economics. But actually, I remember like two interviews I had set up and I didn't show up because I was just like, this is just not, I don't want this job.
Yeah.
So I liked you and Jeff and Corby and everyone that I met, and it just seemed like the right fit. So, and I still thought, you know, maybe I'll get drafted and play for a couple of years. But I remember being on the golf course with a teammate of mine, and they drafted Johnny Manziel in like the 40th round, and he didn't even play baseball. And I said, yeah, I don't think it's happening. If he got it, I think they're probably going to pass over me.
Right. So, golly. Okay. Well, so you get to Mercer Company. This is 2014, right?
Mm-hmm.
You started in Fort Worth, actually, right?
I did. I was there for, I think, September. I started mm-hmm. calling, and I want to say I started in Hines around November, December. So I was there for whatever that is, 3-4 months.
Because Boozer was working Hines. And
he was actually gone by the time I got there.
He was gone by the time you got there.
Mike Gibson was.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So I was Fort Worth, and that was, I was kind of the north, like Fossil Creek, northwest Fort Worth, I guess you'd call that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, it just, there wasn't, I mean, it was probably a great market if you're doing big tenant rep deals.
Yeah.
But there wasn't that low hanging fruit, honestly. Yeah. So it was slow, but yeah, I remember thinking like, I don't know if I'll ever do a single deal in my career. Maybe. I don't know.
That's what I felt like in Turnpike.
Oh man, it was just
really Pinnacle. I go down to Pinnacle and I was like, I don't think I ever did a deal in Pinnacle. I just, I pulled one out of there, but it was like the guy doing freight in the back had a need and wasn't really pulling a tenant out of the building.
So. Yeah, it was tough, but I remember going to the first dove hunt. And, you know, I'd been training for a couple months and I'm thinking, all right, now they're going to find out that I'm a fraud because now I got to actually go and do it.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Jeff and he basically just said, look, I'm not worried about your production. If you go and you get 100% on your action group, you do exactly what we ask you, then I'm good.
Yeah.
And that was like a weight was lifted off my shoulders because I was like, I know I can do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I may never make a deal, but I can go do what I'm supposed to do. You can control that. Yeah. I could go do that.
Yeah.
So that was big for me.
Yeah. So Mike Gibson left and you just said, did you raise your hand or did Jeff bring it up to you? Or?
Yeah. I think Jeff could kind of tell that it just wasn't really a market that was ready for that yet, I don't think, for a guy there just in that specific area of Fort Worth. Yeah,
there's so much institutional type
work. It just was tough. So when that happened, I was feeling like, man, I've got to get somewhere else. Like I remember driving down a street in Regal Row once thinking, this is unbelievable. Like this many buildings on one street, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So I think Jeff probably could sense that and Mike left and he said, hey, we could move you over here. And I was done. Let's go.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's, you know, the owner user type market like that, like, I mean, Brook Hall and Hines are very similar.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more velocity.
You know, a lot of the folks that I would talk to in Fort Worth, and I mean, I had a 3-month snapshot, but it was like, well, my dad built this building. We've been here for 30 years. We're not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know who Mercer Company was at the time, I don't think. So it just was slow moving.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's different now, but yeah, once I got to Hines, I remember driving down Shady Trail thinking, wow, this is a different, I knew I could make money there at that point.
Yeah.
I could see it for sure.
So pretty much 2015, you start in Hines.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
And Hines is such a, I almost want to say like fractured type market. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just got so many weird little pockets in it, but I mean, it's a lot of demand.
It is. It's really a melting pot. You've got just a lot of, you know, you've got a lot of owner user buildings that are under 20,000 feet that are great to sell. You've got some nice tenant rep, class A stuff. Some, but really once I took Valwood on, that's where you get all of that. But yeah, it's an interesting pocket. I feel like the owners there are, they come from a lot of different cultures and they're a little bit more educated on what their buildings are worth, or maybe they're just a little more unrealistic. But you know, it's ever since I've started working there, if it was, hey, market's 50 a foot, all the owners want 85.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been like that. But
I always feel like there's a building that's 90 a foot and then you drive one block over to Harry Hines and they want 200.
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that, which I think I've done.
Draw Larry Robbins listings.
Yeah. I think I've done one deal on Harry Hines. I mean, Harry Hines, the street itself is really a different world. It's not something that is really suited for us, I would say.
Yeah.
So it's a different, there's a lot of different sectors in that one little market.
you know, I've never done a deal on Ambassador Row.
Mm.
It's like the, there you go. That's like the main street of Brookhollow, and I've just never done one there.
Yeah, I did a sublease once, technically on Harry Hines, and that was it. That was all she wrote.
Well, what kind of evolution have you seen in Harry Hines as a market over the past 10 years? Like,
I've really noticed the last, I'd call it 2 years, where the institutional or like these private equity groups are getting more focused on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seemed like for the first 5 to 7 years of me working there, everyone looked down on Harry Hines for, you know, the stuff you typically think of, which I understand. But I was always like, well, dude, we're two exits up the highway from Brookhollow. There's really not that much of a difference in my mind.
No.
And I think just they've bought all the buildings in Brookhollow. And so what's the next closest spot to go is Harry Hines. That's a lot of it.
You know, it's funny how buyers have barriers with like Brookhollow. No one would go to Redbird because the river in Redbird, no one would come to Brookhollow. And even in Brookhollow,
they don't want to go to Hines. They want to skip it.
Well, and I think the Hines barrier's kind of like the Northwest Highway. Yeah. No one can like get their head around going past Northwest Highway.
Yeah.
And Brookhollow people won't even go over to the Regency area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you work that area still. And, but I mean, like, I don't see a lot of back and forth from those tenants.
What's funny is the Harry Hines guys, they never want to go to Brookhollow. Like, I've sold in 10 years, maybe.
Well, the river's another barrier right there. Yeah. The river's maybe right there. You got to go buildings. Across it.
One of the ones I sold, a guy was looking for, you know, it's the old buyers are liars saying, he's looking for a specific 30,000 feet AC. I'd shown him this building. It was in Century Center, but it was south. I'd shown it on paper probably 5 times. He kept saying, I don't want to go further south. I'm like, man, this is literally, if we get in the car, it's probably 8 minutes from your front door.
Yeah.
I finally got him down there to look at it and he bought it. But
isn't it weird how buyers, they tell you what you want, what they want, and you find it and it's just in a little different area like that. And man, you got to like shove it down there. You got to like, sometimes they just won't even go look at it. And you're
it took me probably 4 to 6 months to, I mean, it was basically, we had looked at everything else, nothing else worked. And I was like, man, there's still this option here. And he finally came down.
Yeah.
But yeah, it happens a lot. Anytime someone gives you a very specific, exactly what they want, to me, that's like, hey, I want to be in this zip code.
Mm-hmm.
I almost don't even, I mean, I listen, but it's like, man, I've just seen it too many times where I get super focused on a very specific requirement and then they go do something that is totally not what they said. And you're like, well, I didn't show you that because you said you didn't want to do that.
I'm like, oh, well, I did want to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that has happened so many times
was just
to me.
Part of it.
It is. And so it's like, I always notice when someone wants to, you know, they lay out their parameters and I'm like, all right, go down, you know, if it's 100,000 feet, go up to 200 and go down to 50.
Yeah.
100%. You know, like the parameters need to get spread out pretty far because
especially the last couple of years where if you're looking for 20,000 feet to buy, there wasn't much. It's changing a little bit, I think. But
yeah, it's, you know, I would say probably about 2019, it started getting real. Just, there's nothing to buy. And I mean, I know when I started to be like 30,000 foot deal.
Diamond dozen.
Here's 15 options. Crazy. Let me know when you like to go look. And now it's like, hey, I want to buy a 30,000 foot building. It's like, okay, man. Let you know.
I got one off market that is 20% above market. And that's it. You know, it's something like that.
But you can buy it and own it.
Yeah.
It's funny to think that having the ability to actually own it is a feature now. You can actually own this.
Yeah, it is. It is, especially the last, you know, 5 to 6 years where every renewal is 30% increase minimum. You know, I think if you get a tenant once, twice, like when you do two renewals and you increase it that much, and if it's an individual owner, mm-hmm. usually like the third time he's kind of sick of that game.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to go buy something if he can, if so he's able to.
It, you know, I've seen on renewals, I mean, they're jumping almost 100% on some people, especially if you're coming off a 5 year, you know.
Yeah.
You could be staring down the barrel of going from 5 net to 10 net. And it's, you know, it's a tough situation because on one hand, that's the market.
Yeah.
And on the other hand is, man, the small business is just getting smoked. I mean, you're pretty much taking the owner's salary out of the equation.
Yeah.
And he's going to work for the landlord every day.
Yeah. I always feel like I feel like I'm the bearer of bad news because, you know, I have to tell him, here's where it is. And then you can say whatever, but you have to show them, no, this really is the market. And that takes a good 3 to 4 months, sometimes longer, but you got to do it. I mean,
you do. And, I'm working on, I bought a building and we're working the renewal on it right now. And the guy had a real estate broker for 15 years.
Mm.
And I think he's paying like 550 net and his new rate's 850 net. And I could probably get 9 to 950 for the building.
Yeah.
And he fired his real estate broker because I think his real estate broker was like, this is actually a pretty decent deal.
Yeah. I just feel like you have to, what's the old saying? You can lead a horse to water. You can't make him drink.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to go down that roller coaster ride with them, kind of, you know, where they start and they see the rate and they think this is insane. And, you know, I've found you can't hit them real quick with, no, this is actually right.
Yeah.
You kind of have to nurse it along.
Yeah.
It's less so. I feel like you're experiencing that a little less right now because at least a lot of the clients that I'm renewing, they've already had that one really big uptick. Mm-hmm. So they kind of know the game.
Yeah.
But you still, if you're doing your job, you got to go out and you got to spend time showing them every other potential option, even if you know that, hey, they're not going anywhere. It's just part of it.
It, you know, when I started, there was a lot of power in the tenant rep. You could really create a lot of value and it's tough to create value when all it does is go up.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only thing that I would ever use on people in those times is like, we need to get started as soon as possible because all we have is time on our hands to get this done. So, you know, if you get ahead of it quickly enough, then you have time to massage it.
And, yeah. And it doesn't feel like such a, they've got you over a barrel as badly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's an interesting market because I mean, I'm on that side too. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I'll jack a tenant's rate and, you know, they hate me and tell me I'm the devil and, you know, and all these things. And, but we always just tell them, well, go look. We're not trying to kick you out. We'll work with easing you into this rate. And, we don't expect you to sell your products below market and neither will we, you know?
Yeah.
And, I don't know. It's an interesting time with all of that. And, you know, we were kind of having this discussion this morning, like what about rental increases? Like, is everybody still going to keep, now that inflation seems to be getting tamed, are they going to tame their rental increases? I say institutions will not tame their rental increases. They will continue to push for 4 to 5.
Well, when you started, what was market?
It was like, I don't even remember 10 cents.
I feel like
I don't even remember it being a percent. It was just it was like a number. It was like a number.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, add a dime to it, or if it was even just flat.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I don't think when the cat's out of the bag, I don't think it's going back in there.
No,
but mm-mm.
So, well, okay, so. You eventually expand into Valwood. When did you, is that about when Adam left?
Yeah, it was, him and I were working that area for maybe, I feel like it was like 6 months. It could have been a year. Mm-hmm. I think it was about 2016.
Okay.
And I just, you know, I'd been in Hines for a couple of years, and that was probably 2017. But yeah, I a lot of the quality tenants in Hines, the next progression for their business is to go lease a 30 in Valwood. Mm-hmm. And so it, you know, it really made perfect sense to, I need to work that market too, because that's where a lot of the good options for these guys, that's where they're going. And, you know, at the same time, it's more, Hines is a bunch of individual owners, small businesses. Valwood's more your corporate type of business tenant. So it just was really the natural progression, I think, for me, for my career in specific, to, hey, let's go into a little nicer area and start calling on that too.
So when you started in your career in North Fort Worth, you're kind of calling on the corporate area, don't really have a lot of traction. Do you get a couple laps underneath your belt? And yep. do you feel going into Valwood, did you start getting some traction with corporate tenants at that point?
I did. I always go back to, I just don't think real estate is rocket science. And, you know, kind of going back to my dad, one thing that I'm good at is I can just continue to show up and mm-hmm. do what I'm supposed to do. I think a lot of times that can be a negative because I'm not the most creative guy. I'm not going to have some crazy idea and go make tons of money doing something crazy. But I just found with the corporate world, it's the same game. It just takes more time.
The thing about what you do being on the street is you end up developing relationships with these owner users. And the tough challenge with corporate real estate is that guy could be gone in six months. And
yeah, and it's a lot more over the phone. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I wouldn't emphasize this, but I've had some success emails, like not an email blast, but hey, I've called on this guy 15 times. I've never got him. All right, I'll just shoot him an email. And occasionally I've got someone to respond to that and done a deal just from, you know, for us, an email cold call is like, that's like a sin. Like you don't do that.
You don't even know how to do it.
Yeah. You're like, I can do that. Yeah. That doesn't count. Well, I've had a couple where, you know, I'm calling. And the great thing about Mercer and how Jeff has trained us is if you just keep doing it, it's going to work.
Yeah.
But sometimes you got to also realize, okay, maybe for this guy, I should try something else. This isn't working.
I think I probably would have done twice as many deals if I would have just called the guys that I just went to forever and never. But I felt like I couldn't call. I was like, oh, I can't physically phone call you. That doesn't count. We don't count those.
I'm having that same tension right now.
Yeah.
I've kind of told myself, you know, if I can picture this guy's face, like he definitely knows me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that I'm going to call him every time, but you maybe should just call him because you can save 30 minutes. Because some guys, they just want to
talk.
They just want to talk. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, I would say, again, going back to the beginning, not knowing anything about real estate and just following exactly what Jeff laid out, hey, here's what you need to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I owe so much to him. Just, it works.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm proof. I always tell guys, I'm like, dude, if I could do it, I'm telling you it works.
Yeah.
I'm not some great salesman. I just show up and, I mean, obviously you try hard, you try to progress and develop new tactics, but I don't think there's any secret sauce. And I've learned that with the corporate tenant, you know, I truly think it's kind of the same game. you have to modify it a little bit, but you just got to be there. You got to show up. You got to keep at them.
Yeah. It, I could see, you know, I was pretty good at sticking to the program. I would go off reservation every now and then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I do get wild ideas.
Yeah.
And,
you do.
And Jeff saw me live. He always calls me. He goes, "Hey, I got an idea for you." Cause I know you're an idea guy.
It's funny.
So half mine fall down in a pit of flames, you know, but, you know, talking about the consistency, I just always remember one deal I called on this guy on Regal Row for 4 years and he would never see me. I got him on the phone one time. He laughed at me and hung up.
Yeah.
And then the day he needed a building, he called me and said, I need to buy 50,000 feet right now. They're kicking me out of my building. And I sold him a building, and I haven't talked to him since.
Because
he
still wouldn't
talk to me after we.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
So
there, I always feel like there's. I was calling on a guy today that I've 10 years. I've literally never talked, maybe once on the phone, and I called his cell phone number. It didn't ring, and I was like, "What am I doing, man? This is." But you know, I just the Jeff Mercer in me. I walked in and dropped off. That's something with my card. And I just thought, I mean, if I don't call him, I will never do his deal.
Yeah.
There's no question.
Right.
If I at least leave this, it's probably very low probability, but I've seen it happen like you're saying, where you're like, there's no shot. And then they call you.
Yeah.
So it happens.
Well, so 10 years and tons of success. I mean, you're a CEO power broker, Keenan.
Oh, yeah. Me and everyone else.
I love to hear your hot take on the CEO power broker.
Yeah, it's, they've kind of let, I don't know if it means a lot.
Quality controls?
a little
out of whack.
A little bit, but.
But to that point, you've had a ton of success, many years over. I'm sure you have had numerous opportunities to jump ship and you just never have. And if someone told me Keenan Cook left Mercer Company, then there must be some underlying thing that I was not aware of that happened that would. So
I go back to my dad, my parents. I was just, man, that's just how I am.
Yeah.
You know, it's, the grass is always greener on the other side. I do think people would look at it the other way and say, well, you missed some opportunities, but I'm like, man, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I love the guys that I work with. You know, I just don't really see a reason to do anything different. So I'm pretty simple.
You know,
that's kind of it.
Yeah. But,
no, I've loved it. I mean, again, I'm a Christian and I look back at my life and I see people would say it's just chance that, you know, you go to that career fair day, you end up here. I'm like, well, no, that was the Lord's providence in my life to put me here. And he couldn't have put me at a better fit for me in terms of Mercer Company.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing that I see just how all these chips fell into play perfectly. And being at Mercer for a decade, it doesn't seem that long, but it couldn't have been a better fit. Yeah. So.
Do you still cross paths with Mike Smith? Is he still around Hines?
Yeah.
He's like OG Hines, man.
Yeah, I believe he still offices on Perth.
Right.
Which if you office on Perth,
you are in it.
Respect.
Yeah, you are in it.
That is ground zero.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I still run into him. I showed a building with him 2 weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah.
I just always remember that guy. I think he always gave you fits in the beginning, but I think
we had a little beef at the beginning, but we've been actually good friends for, I don't know, 7 years or so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're all good.
So funny, man. That guy's just
yeah.
I mean, he doesn't leave the pocket.
No, he's been doing it. I don't even know how long he's been doing it. But again, another example of if you just consistently show up.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to say that's all it is, but a lot of folks just don't realize the importance of that. You know, it's like, man, just keep at it.
Yeah. And
he's another example. He's still doing it.
He is, man. Well, what was your worst cold call you ever made?
You know, I was thinking about this. I almost think that being a good cold caller is like, they say, you know, quarterback, you need to have a short-term memory loss because there's a bad one like every day. Yeah. So you kind of have to forget it. But I do remember one, this was, you know what this was like my first year. Remember that building on Crown Road that
we sold? Yeah.
I was on it. Yeah. And so I'm calling all the neighbors and this guy wasn't even a prospect for us. Anyways, I walk in and this guy immediately kind of rushes up to me, which that was the first time that happened to me where someone blitzes you a little bit.
Kind of got your personal space.
You don't really know, are we friends? Are we enemies? What's going on? And he was smiling too. So I thought, oh, this is great. This is going to be my friend and I'll sell him a building. This will be perfect. But, you know, I gave him my spiel. Hey, I've got a building. I think it was literally like two doors down for sale. I mean, I had something relevant. And he said he was not interested, which was fine. And then I said, okay, well, here's my business card and the brochure and I'll get out of your hair. Well, he just stared at me and a couple seconds passed and I tried to give it to him again and I realized he was not going to take it. So now I'm kind of, my anger's welling up a little bit. And so I just said, okay, well, here you go. And I threw my business card at his feet and that's not a good idea. And I remember he picked it up and said, thank you. This now gives me reason to sue you.
Oh,
and I'm like, I'm 23 and no one's ever said they're going to sue me ever. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this guy's going to sue me. But anyways, that was, that, you know, the, when you walk in and there's a big bullpen, no one enjoys that, but you kind of know what to expect. I found when you walk in and someone rushes you real quick, that's when it can go one of two ways. And a lot of times it's not
the good way.
Not the good way. Yeah.
Did you ever go call on him again?
I think I did a couple different times, but he's in a small metal kind of junk space. Yeah. So I wish I could say I sold him three buildings, but no, yeah, I just, don't throw your card at someone's foot. That's not a good way to get their business. I was like, why did I do that? That was not smart. But
man, it's funny how people treat you, man. Then they just, you just walk in there, you're just trying to do your job and man, they just all over you.
Yeah. I always say that to the younger guys, I think a lot of this business is how many times can you get hit in the face and just keep smiling?
Yeah.
You know? You just got to be whatever.
Yeah.
And just have a good, that's I think I heard Todd Hubbard say this, but the Greatest Salesman book, one of the things I remember from that was when you walk into a cold call to meet someone and your mind saying, I love you, which it sounds so silly, but it actually kind of puts you in a good mood.
Yeah.
And, you know, when someone treats you poorly, you're able to just kind of, whatever, roll with the punches a little bit better.
Yeah.
When you have that mindset going in.
That's right. You are an Og Mandino disciple.
Yeah.
Well, you're a plan guy, right? You did the plan.
I did the plan.
That was like the extra credit on the plan.
Yeah.
But that was something you could control. So you could do that.
I could do that.
So that was a big, big game changer for a lot of us. Yeah. You know? So, well, okay. Being in Hines, it can get very dicey on a street corner real quick. What's your diciest situation you've been in on a?
I've got two. I thought one was not dicey, but just weird. You know, Dennis Road? You ever been down Dennis Road?
Yes, yes.
It's probably the worst road. It's definitely the worst road in Hines. There's like a hotel there that the FBI shut down a couple years ago because it was literally the hotel. I think like drug dealers were staying there and you'd come and do drugs and
deal, you know, heroin, go to room number two.
Yeah, exactly.
Meth, room number three.
Yeah. Well, there's, it's one of those streets where there's two gas stations at the corner. And if you go down there tomorrow at 9 a.m., there'll be 70 guys out there, you know, day laborers. Mm-hmm. But it brings a lot of other folks. And one day, it was like a Friday at 10 a.m., sunny day. I'm driving from our old office. I used to cut down Dennis Road to get to Hines. And this guy runs out from the building, from behind the building, and starts running down the middle of the street. And I get up closer to him. He is fully naked. No shoes, nothing.
Just running
down the road at 10 a.m. in the middle of the day.
Like not going for a jog or anything?
No, he didn't look like he was in trouble. He was just running down the road. I thought, that is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. That was just weird. I had one, you know, kind of a typical story, but I sold a building. The business and the building owner used to be one. And then he sold the business and he still had the building, but he was leasing it to his old business partner. And they had had not a good breakup. Mm-hmm. And it was a hydroponic business. Do you remember those?
Oh, yeah.
What is that?
I think it was a front for people that sold to people that were growing weed.
That's what I thought it was. Yeah.
I mean, all the guys that I knew had hydroponic businesses. That's what it was. It's like, oh, you want to grow your own vegetables or weed?
Yeah. Exactly.
Wink, nod, nod.
Yeah. So it was, there were some shady characters. Anyways, I basically got thrust into the middle of this dispute between business owner. And we go to sell the building. The tenant moved out and they put a sign up on the building that said, you know, new location, this big sign. And for some reason that made the building owner, my client, really upset. So he said, hey, I need you to go down there and take that sign down. So I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And so I went down, I cut the sign down, put it in the building. We sold it. No big deal. Everything's good. About 12 months go by and I have to go call on these guys at their new location. And I knew that they didn't really like me, but the Mercer way. I'm like, I'm gonna show up and it'll be good. The front door is locked. So I go around the back of the building and there's like, 5-6 guys out there. It was a cold day. They're all huddled around one of those like steel containers that they've got a fire going on in it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a movie where you if you picture walking down an alley and rolling up on a gang, like this is it. And so I walk around the corner in a suit and I just remember the manager's like, hey, you're the guy who took our sign down. And I mean, it was just me and them. And we're back behind this building with this fire going. And I'm like, dude, I am out of here. I just left. I mean, nothing ended up happening, but it was, I got a feeling like this is not going to end well. So I busted out of there.
But oh, man.
Yeah, it was, I really, in Hines, you see a bunch of stuff that you'd prefer not to see, but I've been fortunate. I haven't had just any crazy scenarios.
Well, why don't you tell me about like a really interesting deal you did? In my mind, I'm kind of thinking the Dimatize deal.
Read my mind.
That one, you went through some hoops on that thing to get it done.
Yeah, that was in 2016. So that was my second full year in the business. And I just remember, I think that we got it under contract in October. Anyways, I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing. I was kind of having a sophomore slump, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And long story short, I'm calling on Harry Hines actually on the street. And I get this guy who they produce energy shots. And the Dimatize buildings had a bunch of food grade type of.
They did like protein powder in there and stuff, right?
So they had a bunch of rooms that were built for food manufacturing. So we get this building under contract. He put $1 million earnest money up. I remember that. And I thought like, man, that's great. He's going to do it. But really what that does is it puts a gun to the guy's head that, hey, I've got $1 million riding on this. If anything goes wrong, I'm out immediately. I'm not going to risk that. So anyway, something happened. I can't really remember, but he terminated without even telling me. I remember I was at Dickie's with Jeff and I saw this email. Long story, we get it back under contract. We reduce the earnest money. We had a bunch of things come up with inspections. You know, I had spent a ton of time getting the building inspected, get answering all the questions. And I'll still remember he called me to his office the day the earnest money was going firm, like at 4 o'clock. He wanted me to come meet him. And I walk into his office and he says, he brought this guy in. It was this warehouse worker from Dymatize. And we had spent thousands of dollars making sure the plumbing in that building was good because that was important. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, this guy says the plumbing's not good. I'm like, dude, what have we've been doing this for the last month? Like, what do you want me to say?
Now it's all down to the warehouse guy.
It's all down to this warehouse guy. And I'm like, I don't even know what to do. Yeah. Anyways, we got past it. Then we get to, we're supposed to close by December 31st. It was probably December 26th. And his bank said, we can't close on time. We need an extension. Well, the seller had like $500,000 in earnest money and there was a bunch of people waiting at the door to buy it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was really okay, we'll just go with someone else and take the earnest money. That was kind of on the table. And my guy said, okay, well, we'll just close it in cash. And he gave me the number. Anyways, he was like $700,000 short of the purchase price. And I was like doing my calculations like, well, purchase price is X and you've got this. Like, there's a gap there we need to meet. And Jeff, this is just tells you about Jeff. Jeff had some, I think he had either 1031 or he had some tenant who had paid a huge security. He had something. He had like 700 or a million sitting.
Just laying around
from a deal. And he said, all right, I'll put it up. I'll get, you know, first lien position. It was just it wasn't to make money.
Yeah, it's just a short-term deal.
It was just a short-term deal to make the deal happen. And to me, that like, who would do that for a broker?
Yeah.
No one. And he didn't do that. Again, he didn't make any money on that. He did that because he wanted me to get that deal done.
Yeah.
For me, not for him.
No, and he's done, I think he's done that again before on a deal. But that's like always in play if you need it. Like you can kind of, he's always willing to throw that out there if the cards are all right.
Yeah.
I've seen him offer that up on other situations.
Yeah. So. When I look back at that, I'm like, man, that's a lot of money. And yeah, we had done our due diligence to make sure everything was fine. But for him to do that, just to see me get this deal done was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I think the guy paid, well, I know what he paid. It was not much at all. And like the next week we got an offer for double that price. And then TxDOT's since come in and taken basically his whole front parking lot and his buildings are still intact. I actually met him last week and I think he pretty much got paid like what he was in the building for his parking lot. I mean, it's been an incredible deal. And to this guy's credit, I mean, he jumped on it. He didn't, you know, he deserves all the credit.
Yeah, he didn't mess around.
It was a roller coaster. And really what it taught me is so that deal was over half my production for that year and it closed on the last day of the year. And it just reiterated in my mind that I want to hit a lot of, you know, baseball analogy, I want to hit a lot of singles, doubles, triples. I don't want to have to hit a walk-off grand slam mm-hmm. in the ninth inning because that's just
nerve-wracking.
It's nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
And so I'm grateful for that deal, but since then, you want to make every deal that you can. You want to make the biggest deals you can, but you got to, in my mind, you got to spread it out to where your whole year is not depending on one transaction. So,
truth.
Preach.
Preach. All right. Well, you know, I asked this, but I think probably outside of just sticking to the plan, what are kind of your habits and routines that you kind of just, what's kind of your ritual things? You know, baseball guys are big ritual guys.
Yeah.
So,
biggest for me is It's very simple. I'll print out my, I still print out an ACT task list. Mm-hmm. Do you do that ever?
No, I hate it. It's the typing was so small. Yeah, I couldn't do it now because I can't read anything anymore.
Yeah, I basically will print that out. And, I think the biggest thing is you got to take control of your own schedule throughout the day. Mm-hmm. Because you can have a lot of days where you look back and you're like, man, I was just kind of running around like a chicken with his head cut off. But what did I really get done here? So I am big on, printing off a schedule and just writing down exactly what I'm going to be doing, whether it's blocking out 2 hours to cold call or, I just want to have it written down what I'm doing that day, nothing special.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the day, go back, look at it and write out a schedule for the next day. I've just found when you do that, you can just be a lot more productive. You have less days where you look up and it's 4:30, 5 o'clock, and you feel like you've done a lot, but you hadn't done anything.
Yeah.
Type deal.
It's the same thing for me. I know when days I don't organize my task list, it's just a mess. And then days when I do, it's just boom, yeah, and boom.
It kind of helps you. It's hard to, there's a lot of days where you feel like you didn't accomplish anything. You had 10 cold calls and you talked to 3 people and you showed a couple buildings and you're like, man, what did I do? But I've just found if I did everything that I set out to do, then I know that was a successful day. Whereas if you don't really have a plan, I think you can just kind of get lost in the muck,
yeah,
so to speak.
Well, what about a book you've read? What's a favorite book you like?
Well, I gotta say the Bible. I give you that.
Yeah.
I preach. For me, it's the Bible says your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. And that's real.
Yeah.
I've just seen in my life that the more I get into God's word, and not just to check off a box, but to say, look, this is the truth. This is how I want to live my life. And I need this. If I don't have this, then everything gets out of whack. So that's number one for me. Another book, I'm the king of, you could ask Abby, I'm the king of, I'll buy like a ton of books and I'll read the first 50 pages and then just stop. But I read the last book I read through last year, it was probably about 70 pages, so that's why I finished it. It was super short.
I got 20 more to go. Yeah. I can do this.
Yeah, you got to set yourself up for success. But it was written by this old English preacher like back in the 1800s, a guy named J.C. Ryle. It was called Thoughts for Young Men. It's really Thoughts for Men in general, but mm-hmm. It's just one of those books that kind of grabs you by the collar and shakes you a little bit. And, he was just saying young men and really men in general, we kind of think that we're invincible, and you don't really think like, and what happens when this is all over? Where am I going to spend my eternity? Like, we just get so involved in the daily stuff that a lot of times it's like, man, you got to wake up and there's more to life than how many deals you did. I mean, we want to try hard and do as much as you possibly can, but there's got to be something bigger that you're living for. And, as a Christian, I think that's faith in Jesus Christ. That's the answer.
Yeah.
So that was a book that just, kind of slapped me in the face recently.
Yeah.
So
cool.
Good.
What's something that no one knows about you? Something interesting or unique?
Well,
or quirky. Doesn't have just anything.
I think this is kind of unique. I didn't miss a day of school until 7th grade. I had perfect attendance from 1st through 7th grade.
What happened in 7th grade?
Well, my sister was getting married in Dallas. And my dad said, hey, I'm going to come get you like at 10 or something. So you'll still get credit. Well, anyways, we had a school-wide assembly that morning. So we didn't go to that class to take attendance. I didn't really realize, I don't think it's that big of a deal, but I just remember every year at the end of the year, the teacher would be like, class, there's one person who has perfect attendance. Do you know who it is? And I would always be smiling because I was like, I know who it is. But yeah, seventh grade, I ruined my run. So again, I think that that's like for me to miss a day of school.
Yeah.
Was like the worst thing that could have happened. I don't know why. That sounded horrible.
Yeah.
Which I just think that's kind of weird. I don't know if everyone feels that way.
You know who had perfect attendance through high school?
Through high school.
Jeff Mercer.
There you go. There you go.
A day.
there it is.
Yeah. He had mono.
Maybe you need to, if you're, we'll tell Jeff, if you're hiring someone, ask go him. Pull their school attendance records.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that might be the ticket.
That might be something. I don't know. I missed a lot of school, but I'm also kind of a problem here and there. I'll mow the lawn.
Yeah.
Like 6 weeks in a row. And then
get on your riding lawnmower and. We can do this. Hey, I can hire that guy. He'll come do it. That's right.
So, well, man, this has been fun. We'll definitely have you on again. But it's cool hearing your story. It's been awesome working with you for so long. Yeah, and man. We own some stuff together. We bought some stuff together, sold some stuff together, brokered a lot of deals together, and we'll probably continue on down that path until we die in office.
So. Yeah. Yeah. No, I gotta say you and Corby and even like Brent Lanfried and Adam, you know, when I started, I had, not only did I have the game plan from Jeff, but I saw you guys doing it. Yeah. So, I mean, it was, y'all taught me a lot without having to teach me. I just saw what you were doing.
Yeah. So, being around.
So thank you.
Yeah. No, thank you.
Yeah.
So. Keenan Cook. Awesome, man. Thank you. We'll see ya.